This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
From our office in Britain, we have Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
And from a field office here in the United States, our Middle East correspondent, Brent Nachtigall.
Good to be with you.
Germany held national elections last Sunday, and the results could mean still more political uncertainty for the leading nation in Europe. For this story, we'll go to Mihailo.
Yeah, so Germany had its elections on Sunday. These are pretty historic elections because this is the first time in a very long time that incumbent German Chancellor Angela Merkel is not running. She's been Germany's chancellor since 2005. She's the senior G7 leader. She's considered one of the most powerful people in the world. And she's decided after four terms as chancellor, she's had enough. And so this has basically been the decision on who's going to succeed the chancellorship of the most populous, most wealthy country in the European Union. And it was a tight race. There was a lot of bitter back and forth exchanges between the multiple parties running. But the results aren't too surprising. The polls actually had it predicted pretty well. Technically, the Social Democratic Party, which was a coalition partner of Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party, won the most seats, but not nearly enough to form a majority government. The Social Democrats, or the SPD, won 206 compared to the CDU's 196. And because of this, unless if the CDU and the Social Democrats decide to form a grand coalition again, that is a coalition between the two major parties, they're going to have to create coalitions with two or perhaps even more parties just to form a government. And these parties, they stand for a lot of different things. They don't agree with each other on a lot of different issues. And so we can see potentially some long-term deadlock like we did with the last election that took a while for a coalition to come together. And this is pretty significant because Germans generally don't like instability. They're known for having a pretty stable political system. So this is bringing Germany into quite a bit of uncharted waters, in, at least for as far as modern history is concerned.
We were speaking before the election about Armin Laschet, the individual who was taking over for Angela Merkel as head of the CSU, or the CDU, sorry. But we haven't talked so much about the SPD candidate who now appears to be the next chancellor of Germany. Can you tell us about him?
Ah, Olaf Scholz. Yeah, he's a very, very interesting figure. He's originally, when Merkel was elected to office, her first cabinet was another grand coalition way back in 2005. And he's been a member of her cabinet even way back then as Minister of Labor. He's the former premier of Hamburg, which is a city with state status in Germany. He's I wouldn't really say he's too charismatic. If memory serves me, I think it was a former U.S. ambassador that said something along the lines of, if you're having trouble going to sleep at night, just listen to one of his speeches and that'll should do you good. But he's definitely a big insider with the Social Democratic Party, and he's been around for a while. He's now serving as Merkel's vice chancellor and her minister of finance, and he sort of snuck in by claiming that because he's been in Merkel's government for so long, he's claiming that, you know, every good thing that Merkel did, all the things you like about her, that's actually our party that did it. We're the real successors. Armin Laschet, of course, is, while he's a member of Merkel's party, he never was a member of her government. And because of this, he's considered about as establishment as it gets. And especially when it comes to the Social Democratic Party, this is really, really interesting. A lot of one of the big pieces of news that the German government has that's come from the German government this year is the completion of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. and that has been spearheaded by the Social Democrats. The Christian Democrats are obviously supportive of it too, but that was basically the baby of Merkel's predecessor, former Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, who's now working for the corporation, the Russian-owned, government-owned corporation that's controlling Nord Stream 2, pumping gas directly from Russia to Germany. That pipeline, we've talked about it so many times, of course, on how it undermines Eastern European security. But with this, he'd be a man to watch to see how he goes along with relations with Vladimir Putin, because the Social Democratic Party is pretty close to the Russian government. The Trumpets obviously watched for Germany and Russia to form a stronger relationship bent on mutual interests. And so this man might play a part in that in the future.
Well, do you have any comments aside from, say, the relationship between Germany and Russia on what is perceived as a shift left for Germany? For a while, we were talking about the shift to the right. We've focused a lot of attention on the Alternative for Deutschland party and the need for German and other European politicians to shift to the right to satisfy anti-immigration and other more rightist policies that Germans and Europeans have been looking for. This seems like it's a shift in the opposite direction.
Oh, definitely. One of the big victors in the party was the Green Party. They were able to catapult themselves. They won about 50 seats and catapulted themselves to third place in the Bundestag. And it remains to be seen on exactly how the coalition government will form, but they are about, just like every other Green Party out there, very much like anti-big business and Green New Deal. Let's basically socialize the economy and make it something more akin to mixed socialism rather than capitalism. Another party to watch, they actually lost seats in this election, but the Die Linke party, which or in German, the left, they're another interesting party to watch. They're the successor to the old East German Communist Party. They don't have too much support. They basically get most of the support from old-timer East Germans who miss the whatever perks they may have gotten from the old communist regime. And there is a lot of talk about Scholz making a coalition between the Greens and the Die Linke. Now, they don't have enough to make a majority. They shy just under that if they were to go through the coalition. But Scholz has said that he's open to making a coalition with Die Linke, which would basically mean the old East German Communist Party will be back in power in Berlin for the first time since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And Die Linke, I mean, they're about as anti-capitalist as it gets, but they're not necessarily, compared to some progressives on this side of the in America, they're not totally against, you know, foreign intervention or dealing with dictators. They're calling to have a Russian reset to make a lot more friendly relations with Russia, which, given Russia was their old sponsor decades ago, makes perfect sense. And it's not really so much a shift to the left as far as German politics is concerned. It's just sort of an anger of the status quo and a belief in the incompetence of Armin Laschet, and so, which is why people are turning to these alternative parties on the one hand, and also to Scholz, who's claiming to carry on Merkel's legacy on the other hand. But in doing so, you're getting these two groups of little parties that ran on different platforms but could actually come together and form something a lot more left than perhaps people were ever anticipating.
Just looking at the political maps on the election results, it's very clear you have extremely strong geographic support for one party or the other, different places in Germany. There's a lot of political division. And the fact that you had votes spread out over, you know, half a dozen parties with none of them getting more than a quarter of the vote, basically, it does show just how divided Germany is. You mentioned just how difficult it was after the last election, even for Angela Merkel to cobble together a government. The nation was without a government for several months. It seems like they're probably in for similar battles in the time ahead.
Oh, this is going to be very, very interesting. Last election, originally, Angela Merkel wanted to create a coalition between her party, the CDU, the Green Party, and the Free Democrats, which are a centrist, middle-of-the-road, classic liberal, pro-big-business party. And those coalition talks broke down. That's why she had to end up going with another grand coalition afterwards. The party politics this time is a lot more polarized. I personally think it'd be unlikely that the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats would make another grand coalition again. But that leaves the Greens and the Free Democrats as the two kingmakers, which we just saw how difficult it was for them to get along last time. Both of them won like about 50 seats in this election. They both became a lot more powerful, you could say, in their position as kingmakers. And so whichever, whether it's the Social Democrats or the Christian Democrats, most likely are going to have to try and get these two groups. One of them is very pro-big business, the other one very anti-big business, to agree together. And if the last election is a sign of anything, that's not going to be easy. And so we might be in for a lot more political deadlock of just coalition negotiations than even last time.
Well, we appreciate you bringing us up to speed on all of that. Now, we have talked a lot about the prophetic implications of Germany's political uncertainty. Maybe you can just give us an overview and direct listeners to where they could get more information about the prophecy.
Sure. Well, Germany or West Germany and then United Germany afterwards since World War II has been characterized by political stability. You had the two main parties. You had the Free Democrats, which jumped from coalition to coalition. You had long-serving chancellors. You had stability. Since Angela Merkel, the last election and this one, since her reign has come in, you've seen that stability absolutely collapse. You've seen Germans extremely dissatisfied with the political system. You've seen various political parties, extremist political parties popping up, each trying to take their own piece of the pie of the Bundestag. And we haven't seen that since the Weimar Republic. It isn't nearly that as extreme as that point. But if anybody who knows a thing or two about German history, the Weimar Republic, the Republic right before the rise of the Nazis, what ended up happening was the Germans wanted a strong man to come and fix all these problems and to end all these political problems. There were other issues too, but that was one of the main ones. And of course, the strong man then they found was Adolf Hitler. And as German politics keeps getting more fractured and more polarized, more and more similar to what it was like in the Weimar era, you can see you're going to see a lot more Germans calling for some kind of strong man to come and bring more stability, to give the Germans the stability they're used to and that they want. And our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, he wrote a booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, which talks quite a bit about that. It goes into a bit of how weak Merkel has been in certain fronts, such as the Ukraine crisis, and that's another issue that bothers a lot of Germans foreign policy-wise. And you're seeing Germans want like a stronger leader, someone to sort of set things right, to make Germany great again, so to speak. And that booklet especially brings into perspective on how relevant this is for now and how we can expect a charismatic, strong-armed German leader to come and take over. And once he does, you're going to see Germany, never mind make Germany great again, you're going to see a complete U-turn or all this instability and see Germany and Europe as a whole become a much more powerful force in the world that nobody is expecting or realizing just how powerful.
A Strong German Leader is Imminent is the name of the booklet that gives you the prophetic story about what is happening here and how this could play out in Germany. We also have an article by Richard Palmer, The Winner of the German Election is Nobody, available in the show notes for today's program. That was up on the website this past week. Thank you very much for all of that, Mihailo. Japan will also be getting a new leader next Monday. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, it was only a year ago that we were talking about Japan's longtime Prime Minister Shinzo Abe resigning and being replaced by Yoshihide Suga. That was September of 2020. But things didn't go very well for Suga. The Japanese were unhappy with his slow rollout of the COVID vaccine and the fact that they're now grappling with their worst waves of the disease. They were also unhappy with the decision to host the Olympics in Tokyo this year, despite the worsening pandemic. So Suga's approval ratings over the summer dropped to an all-time low, and he announced his resignation last month. And then on Wednesday, the party that he led, the Liberal Democratic Party, elected Fumio Kishida as their new leader. And so as head of the LPD, Kishida will also become the new prime minister of Japan early next week. So this will make Kishida Japan's 100th prime minister. So a big milestone there for a country that's famous for having a revolving door on the prime minister's office. The government has really only existed in its current form since the end of World War II, so 75 years or so ago, and yet they've had 100 prime ministers now. But Kishida has worked previously as Japan's defense minister and also as its foreign minister, and he is now head of the nation with the world's third largest economy, fifth most powerful military, and 11th largest population. So, you know, Japan is an immensely powerful and a tremendously important country, and this leadership transition gives us a lot to keep a close eye on.
So tell us about Kishida and what his prime ministership may mean for Japan.
Yes, well, Kishida is very much on the same page as his predecessors, Yoshihide Suga and Shinzo Abe, in terms of foreign policy and in terms of security matters. So we should expect, I think, a continuation of all of those more hawkish policies that Abe especially played such a notable role in really bringing to the fore. And that means being very vigilant about China's increasingly aggressive military posture, also being vigilant about North Korea's aggression. And it means continuing to build up Japan's military power, just to ensure that it can counter all kinds of threats in the region, and also to make sure that Japan can even assert its interests in an Asia that's becoming more and more tense and home to more potential flashpoints. I think we especially need to watch how Kishida views the Senkaku Islands there in the East China Sea, because Chinese maritime law enforcement vessels have been just pressing their claims to those disputed islands to alarming levels lately. And that, I think, could become a major flashpoint very quickly. But in either case, when it comes to foreign policy and when it comes to military normalization, continuity will mean that Prime Minister Kishida will just keep on building up and normalizing Japan's military.
Now, the prophetic picture that we expect in Asia is one of cooperation eventually. And the more we see this kind of contention between Japan and China in particular, it seems to run kind of counter to what we may expect, prophetically speaking. Maybe you can just explain that aspect of the story.
Sure, yeah. Right now, Japan and China are bitter rivals, and they are boosting each of their military capabilities largely out of fear of each other. But if you look at the prophecies in the Bible about an end-time force called the Kings of the East, then you see in passages like Ezekiel 38 especially, you see that China and Japan will eventually both be in that multinational force working together, not against each other, but pooling all of their power together. So even though it is currently concern about each other that's driving a lot of their defense advancements, they'll soon end up just amalgamating all of their forces and fighting together in the Third World War. That's what Bible prophecy shows us. And the scriptures don't tell us exactly what would cause that transition with Japan, but I think if you just think about the geopolitical realities of it and envision a time when America is no longer on the scene. You know, Japan has been dependent on the U.S. for its security for about 75 years now. And if the U.S. were to succumb to a lot of its bitter divisions and no longer be the guarantor of Japan's security, then I think it's easy to see that the Japanese would quickly decide that it would be in their best interest, just as a short-term survival tactic, to band together with China and with Russia. And so I believe that's probably one of the likely scenarios that we could expect to happen, you know, to see Japan kind of shift, make that drastic shift that we're expecting.
Yeah. Where would you send people for just a better understanding of the bigger prophetic picture of what will happen in Asia?
We have one of our trends articles. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. And this goes through all the relevant Bible scriptures and all the prophecies that just tell us what to expect there.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. The Biden administration is making a significant change from the preceding administration in its dealings with Egypt. And this could have some troubling historical associations. To learn about this, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, the Biden administration has decided over the past week or so to start withholding military aid to Egypt and really conditioning the continuation of military aid to Egypt on a improvement of human rights inside Egypt. This, of course, Egypt right now is led by the former general, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and he does rule like a strong man. He does curtail freedoms of speech that might have been more active in the West, or at least used to be. And so he is target number one, it seems, from the Biden administration, and really going after him to try and say, well, it's time now, if you want to be our ally and our friend, continue in that relationship, continue to receive a lot of military aid, which Egypt has done over the past 40 years, then you're going to have to improve on not cracking down on dissenters as much as you have done. Now, chief among these dissenters, of course, in Egypt, is the Muslim Brotherhood Party, really a conglomerate of Islamists that not necessarily all of them believe in absolute radical Islam taking over the world, but all of them do believe in the need for Islamist Sharia law to be at play inside Egypt. And then many of them do believe in the use of terrorist activities and or the desire for Islam to take over the world. And so you've got this really difficult position that Sisi's in right now. He can either allow the propaganda to be put out by the Muslim Brotherhood that would foster a strengthened position inside Egypt, and coming with that threaten the stability of Egypt going forward and his own rule on the one hand, or curtail that and stay in power, but then lose, it seems, an ally in the United States. So the United States is basically this. I think this is a shot across the bow. This isn't extremely important for Egypt, this $130 million of military aid. They did agree to send $170 million in military aid. So they basically cut it in half of what Egypt was going to going to receive. But it does show where the Biden administration's desire is, what it means going forward. Human rights better improve, which means cracking down on the Muslim Brotherhood, or our relationship is going to get worse and worse with your government.
Sisi is a pretty tough leader, but the Trump administration certainly made the decision to go ahead and back this man because of the way that he's preventing Egypt from falling into the hands of more radical elements that are certainly within that nation. You think back to what happened during the Obama administration, where you had another strong Egyptian leader that Americans basically decided it was pragmatic to support in order to prevent that. Obama decided something different, and you quickly saw just what could happen in Egypt without that strong presence holding down those radical Islamist elements. It seems like in some ways we have something like the stage being set for a repeat of what happened before.
Yeah, this was the initial sign of the Obama administration that there was going to be a massive shift in the Middle East in terms of alliances. The relationship with Iran, the Iran nuclear deal, that really surfaced publicly in 2013. But back when he took office in 2009, everyone remember the Cairo speech, which Mr. Flurry focused on how the Cairo speech will shake the nations, is an article he wrote back then and talked about how this was a massive shift away from America's traditional allies. And instead, it was a sign to the Muslim world that America is going to embrace you. And that's what we've seen. That was the policy of the Middle East for Obama. It was weaken America's relationships with strongman autocrats, whether they be in the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or Egypt, and strengthen the grassroots relationships in those countries with Islamists, the Muslim Brotherhood being the most active in all three of those. And with that speech, and then with the phone call that went to Hosni Mubarak from Obama that was very public and said, you need to step down, the pressure was immense on Mubarak, and he did that. And then the Muslim Brotherhood, in a popular democratic, Egypt's first democratic election, mm-hmm. took place, which is one of the human rights that they're calling for, the United States Biden administration is calling for right now, is democratic elections. You had the Muslim Brotherhood naturally come to power. Unfortunately, this is the case in the Middle East. You have two choices, a strong man that's going to put at bay the radical elements within his own populace, using human rights abuses, let's say lessening freedom of speech, cracking down on dissenters, or you have radical governments. That's it. They're your two choices. And so the United
well,
States.
Well, I guess the one exception to that would be Iran, and you look there at the fact that the Obama administration actually undermined popular resistance to the oppressive government, and right. It was a very stark contrast between its approach toward Iran and its approach to Egypt. But the common denominator in both cases was that it was the radicals that it was supporting.
Right. So they use, of course, the as you say, the underlying foreign policy is the strengthening of radical Islamic elements. If that element's already in power, yeah, we'll crack down on those democratic elections. Because if they were democratic elections, Iran, you would probably see actually a more moderate turn, because they've been under that rule for 40 years. They know where it goes, the populace, where these other governments haven't been. And so we have expected for 30 years now, based on the prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 and the first 40 to 45, that Egypt itself is going to undertake a radical transformation. There is going to be a radical power, or let's say a Sharia-based government in power, and that the strongest force for that in Egypt is the Muslim Brotherhood. And so Mr. Flurry did forecast the Muslim Brotherhood takeover in Egypt, and that forecast is still valid. We saw it take place when Obama was in power the first time. And of course, Sisi rose up out of Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Morsi's government and said, this is crazy. We need to stop this right away. And he led a military coup. And that's how he came into power. And the Middle East at that point was rejoicing. Israel, the Saudis, all America's traditional allies were very happy with that coup, because they knew what was next if it didn't happen. Now, right now, you have the Biden administration in power. And what does he want to do? He wants to, again, strengthen the radical elements within Egyptian society. And this is a danger, because the America has a lot of power when it comes to aid to Egypt, and conditioning that aid upon allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to participate in elections and things like that. Now, Sisi, it seems, knows it's an existential threat to his rule. So I don't know how much he's going to budge. But again, it's the bizarre foreign policy of the Biden administration. It seems bizarre. Why would you want to destroy the relationship with a strongman that protects American interests in favor of radicals that believe in America's destruction? We see this happening, whether it's the Taliban, whether it's strengthening the Iranians as well. And now, where there is allies in power, America strengthens the opposite side. And again, looking to biblical prophecy, Egypt is of particular note, because we know that that country is going to take a shift towards a relationship with Iran going forward. And so the Biden administration seems to be furthering that with decisions such as this.
Yeah, as you said, withholding less than half of America's military aid to Egypt isn't the decisive factor that's going to switch things in Egypt necessarily, but it certainly does tip Biden's hand, and it shows the orientation of American foreign policy with Joe Biden in office. Just to direct listeners to where they would be able to learn more about this really stunning prophecy about Egypt's future and its alignment with Iran in the future, where would you send them?
We have a trend article on that which shows where Egypt is going to turn based on the Bible, and that's called Iran Allying with Egypt.
Another interesting foreign policy move by the Biden administration. On the other side of the world, this with Australia, has other nations quite upset with America. For this story, we'll go back to Mihailo Zekic.
Yeah, so cooperation between America and Australia in military terms, economic terms, et cetera, that's nothing new. They're already members of the ANZUS alliance, the Quad alliance. But they decided to add one more, and this time include the United Kingdom in with it. They've decided to form what they call the AUKUS, or Australia-United Kingdom-United States alliance between the three of them. And this is interesting in a number of trends. First off, this is post-Brexit. This is Britain talking about global Britain being more involved in the rest of the world and even reaching out to, in this case, one of its former colonies. And with the U.S., it's been, while, as mentioned, the U.S. already has Australia, New Zealand, that area there sort of under its security umbrella, the AUKUS alliance involves a massive new reinvestment into Australia from the United States' perspective. One of the biggest activities that Washington will now be partaking with Australia is selling Australia 8 nuclear submarines. This is a pretty big deal. Aside from Australia, there are only 7 countries in the world that own nuclear submarines. These guys are about you can't get much more bang for the buck than these guys. Australia currently uses diesel submarines. They can only patrol for about 11 days without before turning around, while nuclear submarines can take that to 77, 7 times what a diesel submarine can use. And America is selling 8 of them. This is mainly like to counter the threat from China. China has been showing itself pretty bellicose in the Asia Pacific region for a while, threatening Taiwan with annexation, having spats with Japan, its annexation of islands claimed by the Philippines and the South China Sea. Australia, of course, is right next door. It's a wealthy country, relatively small military infrastructure, and it makes it perhaps a, of course, it's a Western ally, and makes it perhaps a very easy target if China ever wanted to go on the warpath. The Chinese, of course, aren't really taking too well with this. The Global Times, which is an English language newspaper owned by the Chinese government, called AUKUS a reason to make Australia a potential target for a nuclear strike. The Global Times is a bit infamous for its very aggressive vitriol against anything America does in the area, or Australia, or any of the other Western countries that harms China's interests. But this isn't the only, the nuclear submarines aren't the only part of this deal that makes it particularly attractive for Australia. There's also considerations for Australia to develop longer range missiles, for American nuclear submarines to be stationed at the port of Perth, which is on the west coast of Australia, and for even more American Marines to be moved over into Darwin, which is Australia's northern port and one of the geographically one of the parts of the country most close to China.
So this certainly is providing Australia a certain hedge against incursions from China. So there are definitely some interesting strategic ramifications to this deal within the sphere of Asia and Australia. But Europe is really upset about what has transpired here. Can you just tell us why that is the case, and particularly France?
Oh, definitely. France is fuming at this. You would think not, considering they're all Western allies. They all have an interest in countering China. France has a lot of overseas territories in the Indo-Pacific, and they consider China to be a threat to. They've been making like military agreements with Japan, for example. But the big thing about this is that Australia right beforehand had agreed with France to buy more diesel submarines from Paris, worth about $90 billion. And America came up with a more attractive option. We just mentioned some of the factors of the diesel submarines and how they're inferior to nuclear submarines. And Australia said, well, you know what, they gave us a better offer, so that's what we're going to go with. And granted, I mean, I don't think France would have been happy either way, but the reaction from Paris has been especially very furious at America, at Australia, at Britain. The French government actually recalled their ambassadors from Australia and the United States. This is the first time this has ever happened. And while they decided to keep their ambassador in the UK, they actually said that the only reason for doing so is because they're used to London's, quote, permanent opportunism, unquote. And I mean, it's no secret that France and Britain have had quite a few spats about this as well. And it's not just France that's getting angry at this. I mean, of course, they're the European country that has most gain or to lose with AUKUS and everything that's happening there. But you're also seeing some in Germany also get quite angry about this as well. Die Welt, a important daily in Germany, very popular national newspaper, called the alliance AUKUS basically as a declaration of war on the EU. Germany's ambassador to Britain actually said that the deal threatened the, quote, unity of the West, unquote. So you see other people in Europe getting really antsy about this, even though theoretically with Britain and America, they're all NATO allies. They all have some sort of interest in countering China at this point. The fact that it shows just how much antagonism they're having towards the Anglosphere, the Anglo-Saxon countries. And this is, of course, on the building off of a lot of other spats that Britain and America and other English-speaking countries have had with the with European countries, especially France. Like a while back, the row between the French fishers intruding on the British island of Jersey, which caused a spat where both France and Britain ended up sending warships to each other. So this is like one more straw getting on the camel's back, and the camel's back is getting pretty wary at this point.
So just looking at the relationship between France and Europe and the United States, this is something that we have watched closely over the years because of its prophetic implications. We don't expect that to be strong. In fact, there is betrayal in the offing, according to Bible prophecy. Can you explain about that?
Of course. Well, longtime listeners to the radio program will be familiar with our forecast of a united European superpower forming in the European continent. We look at prophecies like Revelation 17 or Revelation 13, for example. Isaiah 11 is another one. But most of the focus we've been having is on Germany and the rise that Germany will have as a German strongman to lead the whole group. And granted, Germany is the main player in this, but they're not the only one. Revelation 17 specifically says there'll be 10 kings or 10 nations coming together in all of this. Germany is only one of those 10. France is another one that we're watching out for. And especially, it has a really unique history of, and we often toot the United States and Britain prophecy on this program, which explains how America and Britain are descended from the Israeli tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim, or the sons of Joseph. There were other Israelite tribes too, one of them being Joseph's brother, Reuben. And in Genesis 37, there is an account of some of Joseph's brothers wanting to kill Joseph out of jealousy. And Reuben, who was the firstborn, hears about all this and gets them to agree to a compromise. He doesn't per se want to hurt Joseph, but he brings up a weak compromise. Let's not kill him. Let's just throw him into this pit in the ground and then leave it at that. And then while Reuben decided to turn his back for whatever reason, the brothers took Joseph and sold him into some nearby slave traders. So some people could look at that account and think that Reuben was protecting Joseph, but this was a really weak compromise that basically betrayed his brother, even though Reuben knew better. And we look at France, it's one of the most powerful countries in the EU. It's the only one that has nuclear weapons of its own, has one of the strongest economies, largest populations. It's a very Catholic country, and we, as Revelation 17 brings out, we expect there to be a religious dimension in all of this. And so France would be one of the pillar countries of this core Europe coming together. And as the spat with what just happened with AUKUS and all that kind of stuff, you're seeing France, which is traditionally allied with Britain and America in both world wars, you're seeing it increasingly turn against and become more hostile to them, which is going to lead up to an eventual betrayal from France against Britain and America.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We do have an article on the website, and we'll link to it in the show notes, about that betrayal. France is betraying America and fulfilling Bible prophecy, by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. We also have an article that went up last week from Richard Palmer about this AUKUS deal, why the ruckus over AUKUS, that explains this, the specifics of the deal. And we'll also link to the United States and Britain in prophecy. Thank you, Mihailo. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, startling revelations about how a huge number of nations are even more deeply indebted to China than has been realized, and the increase of troubling cooperation between Venezuela and Iran. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Here is a stunning story coming out of China. Through secret off-the-books lending, China has brought an extraordinary number of other nations deeply into its debt. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was a new report by the Aid Data Research Institute, and it shows that a staggering $385 billion worth of Chinese debt to other countries has been hidden from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So these are loans associated with China's Belt and Road Initiative. That's the massive infrastructure project that Beijing is using to make other nations better connected to China and also more dependent on China. And we've long understood that many aspects of the Belt and Road's finance program were murky. We've understood that many of the loans are given out to other countries on terrible terms for those borrowing countries. And that has even resulted in some countries, such as Sri Lanka, defaulting on the loans and then having to give China control over some of their national assets. So we've seen for years that the Belt and Road is a dangerous program for countries to sign on to. But this new report proves that it's considerably worse than most analysts understood. I'll just read one section of it here. It says, China systematically underreports its debts to the World Bank's debtor reporting system by lending money to private companies in lower middle income countries rather than to state institutions. This makes it difficult for debtors and multilateral lenders to assess the costs and benefits of participating in the Belt and Road Initiative. It also heightens the possibility of debtors falling into debt traps with only one way to climb out, by selling geopolitically important assets to China. End quote. So China's pulling this off by making many of its loans go to private entities in the other nations instead of to national entities. And that's keeping a lot of the debt off the main balance sheets. But that doesn't mean that the money isn't owed, and it doesn't mean China won't soon come knocking for it. So this could really give China just an immense amount of leverage over those borrowing countries. And China, I think right now, they know that the U.S. is not in much of a position to defend deadbeat sovereign nations if they were to default. So I think this could give China a perfect way to occupy foreign territory without even having to go to war.
We have talked about just the ramifications of China's debt trap diplomacy, indebting these other nations in such just looking for any kind of leverage, economic leverage over these countries that puts them in China's debt. The fact that that this has been so underreported, that it's on such a much greater scale, and the fact that they're doing it in ways to specifically, deliberately obscure the level of debt. It shows just how determined China is to use this as a weapon against other nations. It really does give you some insight into China's inner workings and the way that this operates under the Communist Party.
Yes, I think it does reveal a lot of the disturbing darkness behind China's ambitions. And it's also just stunning, I think, to look at how many countries are involved here. These hidden loans are mostly to lower income countries and lower middle income countries in Africa and Asia. And one part of the aid data report says, we estimate that an average government is underreporting its actual and potential repayment obligations to China by an amount that is equivalent to 5.8% of its GDP.
Wow.
End quote. So that is just huge, 5.8% of GDP, and that's just what is not reported. So that's in addition to the vast amounts that are in the official books. So if you look at the whole picture, the report says that 42 countries now have levels of public debt exposure to China in excess of 10% of GDP. And then for a few, it's north of 30%. So just very worrying. And I think we could soon see China come collecting in these countries and basically telling some of them that they can either become a client state to China or they can hand some of their key assets over to Chinese control. So in either case, this shows that China's global power is rapidly growing and set to grow much more.
42 countries that have 10% of their GDP in debt to China. I mean, this is a huge part of the world. 42 countries, you're talking about a quarter or more of the countries the world over. And that's not all of the countries that are indebted to China.
Right. Yeah, there's a total of 165 countries participating, which have some level of debt to China. But for these 42, it's at these alarming levels that could very soon lead to some sort of handover of national assets to Beijing.
Well, that is quite concerning. Well, to have this level of control over other countries, this shows that the world economy really is moving away from the United States and toward China in some really alarming ways. And that really does have some strong prophetic implications.
It does, yes. Isaiah chapter 23 talks about a mighty block of nations that will be formed in our lifetimes. And the scriptures show that it will be so powerful that it will soon be able to block the United States out of world trade. It's called a mart of nations in verse 3 of the chapter. And one of the main powers in this block is a people called Chittim. And that is an ancient name that indicates modern China. So when we see China ensnaring dozens of weaker countries into its debt traps and just gaining all this unbelievable leverage over these countries, and when we see China just exerting its influence so broadly over more and more of its neighbors and even countries in Africa, it is all building Beijing's power a great deal, and it is creating the foundation for China or Chittim to play a major role in that Mart of Nations trade bloc.
Well, we will link to an article about that in the show notes for today's program. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Now to Iran and Venezuela increasing their cooperation in a move with concerning implications for the United States. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this past week, Venezuela agreed to a key contract to swap its heavy oil for Iranian condensate, which helps to allow Venezuelan oil to access, well, to be used so it can be, to be useful, so it can be sold on the open market. Now, both these countries are under the United States sanction right now, and the Trump administration had worked hard to prevent such activities such as this from actually helping both Venezuela and Iran move forward economically. Now, there's a couple of things that are concerning about this, and that is that Iran is getting more and more active in the Western Hemisphere through its relationship with Venezuela. This is something that has actually been around since Ahmadinejad, going back 20 years. However, during the Trump administration, you had a firm commitment from his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, at the very beginning to really attack this relationship and place a lot of individuals under United States sanctions and a lot of companies under United States sanctions to prevent this, because it was seen by the Trump administration as more than just a relationship of allowing both nations to access funds. It was actually seen by Michael Flynn, and he wrote about this in his book, as part of a very important terror nexus that brought Iran to the Western Hemisphere for future attacks against the American homeland, something that could be very dangerous. Now, we don't have evidence of that, but we do have evidence of Iranian tankers arriving this past week in Venezuela, coming out with lots of oil, and you have them bringing in this, again, important condensate that's used to make Venezuelan heavy oil usable and for use to be sold on the open market as well.
So talk more specifically about the contrast between the Trump administration's approach to this, what they did to prevent this kind of coordination and cooperation, and then what we're seeing from the Biden administration and why this is actually illegal.
Right. So the United States government has sanctioned entities that it believes, they're either working with in terrorist circles, or even like Venezuela, that it believes that its government is fundamentally corrupt. You would sanction it to try and pressure it to change, make the government fall. And so for various reasons, I think Venezuela and Iran are under sanction. Iran's more the terrorist activities, in Venezuela, it's more the absolute corruption of its government and so on. So the United States, President Donald Trump did actually confiscate a couple of tankers full of oil last year that were making its way to Venezuela, and actually sanctioned five sea captains of different vessels and brought that oil to the United States. And this is something the Biden administration has refused to do. There have been a number of tankers that have arrived over the past 6 months to Venezuela. The relationship has been allowed to thrive. It is not interfering at all. Now, several reports of this talk about how it's up to the government's discretion whether they're going to enforce the sanctions or not, to try and give the Biden administration a pass. But basically, he's allowing this relationship to be nurtured and strengthened with Iran and Venezuela. And this is concerning because we already know that Iran is sending over some of its key officials, military officials, to Venezuela. They're working together in observation posts in northern Venezuela to keep eyes on what the United States is doing. We have a history of the Venezuelan oil minister that's running all these oil deals right now, and his association with the Iranian government, giving them hundreds of Middle Easterners Venezuelan passports to access the Western Hemisphere. And so while there's a lot still that's under the surface right now, a closer relationship between these two countries isn't just from Iran's side of it for economic purposes. This is a way of Iran, again, establishing its own presence in Venezuela with helping it in the potential for attacks against the United States. Now, the other side point of this is you have hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans right now crossing the southern border into the United States. Over the past 6 months, Venezuela has been, if not one, number one or number two of foreign nationals entering the United States. And many of these are just let loose. And so when you have a history of Iran getting Venezuelan passports and you see that they're bringing Iranians to Venezuela right now, it stands to reason that the Iranians would be interested in bringing some of its agents to the United States through this loophole. And so while we don't have evidence of that right now, it stands to reason that Iran would choosing to act in that fashion.
This, as you mentioned, is a story that has been around for quite a long time. The concerns of Iranian terrorists making their way across the United States southern border via Venezuela, and the presence that has been known to have been quite strong, Iran's presence there in Venezuela, enabling the potential for some of these terrorists to make their way into the United States. As you said, as much as this has been talked about, and the possibility seems so strong. We haven't seen, you know, terror cells in the United States actually active. There have been rumors and rumblings and reports, but it does seem like it is just a matter of time before something like that actually ends up biting the United States in the throat.
Yeah, for sure. And I think people need to know that, you know, Iranian agents, Hezbollah agents that are proxy of Iran, they're in the United States right now working with Mexican drug cartels. That's heavily well known. I think Hezbollah is with, I forget the number two cartel that operates in the United States from Mexico. So they are there right now. Their aims were all financial as a way of getting black market money to Hezbollah and Iranian proxies. But at some point, it seems that those could be used to switch their main business of activity as well.
Anywhere that you would send readers just to understand the prophetic implications of what we're talking about?
Yeah, for sure. This is another sign that America is under attack from this Biden administration, allowing this relationship to go forward. And we wrote about this in an article entitled Iran Establishing a Base of Operations in Venezuela back in May 2020.
Thank you, Brent. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Mihailo Zekic, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Leonardo da Vinci. As a well-spent day brings happy sleep, so a life well-spent brings happy death. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.